Friday, April 5th. I was up early, probably not to anybody in the city. Was it a restful night? I went into Lyndon's room for coffee. He was still firm in his feeling that I should go. And my one thought for staying was any comfort that I could give him. He had Linda and Lucy and Patrick and Lynn. Liz called and I told her it was on. We both recognized we'd have to make some changes in the speeches. The world had changed overnight. Mr. Pear came for a come out. I told Lucy goodbye. Liz and I both felt I should hit it as soon as I got on the plane. Make a statement about the killing of Dr. King. And then go on with the welcoming speech I had planned. She had typed an opening sentence. And I wrote out in longhand my feelings on what I should say. Then it was time to get in the car with Stuart and head for Dulles. We stopped under the nose of the plane. How many times we've done it. Above was the map of our trip. And its title, Crossing the Trails of Texas. There were pictures. Then we went up, and as I went down the aisle, I put out my hand to right and left and met all the foreign correspondents, 38 from 13 European countries, a sizable contingent of Washington press. I sensed a feeling of uncertainty, tension in the air. As soon as we were aloft, I went to the PA system, and in a quiet, serious voice said, "We travel with a heavier heart today because of the tragedy of Dr. King's death. Every man must look into his own heart and ask himself if his every word, every act, leads toward peace and healing in our country. This lays a demand on all Americans for understanding, self-control, and steady, determined work to attack the problems that made possible such violence. The greatest tribute we could pay to Dr. King is to bring forth from this cruel tragedy some good action on our problems." Yeah. And then I put it behind me with a change of tone and welcome them on a journey to the part of our country that I know best. The jolly air, the banner, that's usually there when these trips begin, was absent, but I thought the tension lessened. An enormous cattleman's brunch was served, steak and eggs and sweet rolls and orange juice and lots of coffee, preceded by Bloody Marys, which never fails to shock me. At 10 o'clock in the morning, as soon as I was through, I had an interview with the German press because Fredericksburg was our first destination on the trip. There were about 8 of them, I think. One sat beside me and one perched on an arm, and the rest of them squatted or leaned around, and I told them about Fredericksburg. In a way, we were capsulated, sealed off from the world in the plane. We arrived in San Antonio. There must have been headwinds. About 12:30, there were John and Nellie at the foot of the ramp, and the long line of the red-coated welcoming committee, headed by Mayor McAllister. And there was the Reverend McAllister and his wife. Briefly, I glimpsed Nancy Negley and Jessica Cato. It was a short ceremony, a welcome from the governor and Mayor McAllister, a brief response from me, and then we boarded buses to Fredericksburg under a brilliant April sun, and I pointed out bright flags of bluebonnets and coral Indian paintbrush along the roadway, and over the PA system told them about the wildlife of the hill country, live oaks and caliche land, German stone houses, an occasional log cabin. And just a little before 2 o'clock, on time, we drove into Fredericksburg. We got out of the buses in front of the Nimitz Hotel. There was a sizable crowd, lots of familiar faces. We piled into orchard wagons, decorated, alas, with pink and blue crepe paper flowers, each one pulled by a tractor, about 12 of us in each, and a guide in the lead seat. Mr. Petmecki on his wagon, telling the history and the sights of Fredericksburg in German. Mrs. Covert was our guide, and a delightful one. Except that the tractor almost drowned out her interesting story of the old Nimitz Hotel, built in 1852 in the shape of a ship, and a young son of that home, some 80 or 90 years later, Chester Nimitz, who became Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet in World War II. He told me things I'd never known before, that a silversmith had designed the bow and arrow transom from a Kurt Keitel home for the nicest details in town, and that the building with the white elephant above the door had been, naturally, the White Elephant Saloon. She pointed out the birthplace of Franz von den Stücken, who achieved worldwide fame as a composer and conductor, getting his education in Europe under Edvard Grieg, and returning to America to be the conductor of the New York Philharmonic and the Chicago Symphony and the Cincinnati Symphony. friend of Liszt and Grieg and Verdi. She pointed out the statue of John Moisebach, who'd led the settlers here and given up his title of baron, who'd negotiated a treaty with the Indians in 1847, had started trade between them and the pioneers, and the delightful old courthouse that the Eugene McDermotts had done over and turned into a pioneer memorial library and community meeting hall. And she told about the custom of the early pioneer having his business place fronting the street, his saddle shop by general store, a barber shop, and then building his home behind it. Old St. Mary's Catholic Church, built in 1861, with its stone steeple adding a touch of old-world charm to the landscape. And then, as we passed one of the Sunday houses, there was a couple, dressed in the costumes of the day, rocking on the front porch, and some children playing out front, just as Mrs. Covert was describing the use of the houses by the pioneers. And they would come in over the weekend to do their trading, attend their parties or civic meetings, and go to church. We stopped at St. Barnabas's and got out briefly. We told how the Peter Walter family had built the house in 1846, and the grapevine in the back on the arbor had been brought by him from Germany. And here the family had lived until in the 1950s it had been bought by the Episcopal Church. He showed us Cross Mountain, where the early pioneers had found the remnants of a cross built by the Spanish missionaries sometime in the 1700s, and described the Easter fires. He made a longer stop at the John Peter Totch house, walked through and saw examples of the work of the cabinet maker, enormous fire.